Well, aloha. It's 4 o'clock, time now for Out of the Box. I'm your host, Dave Giroux, and this is KKCR's, one of KKCR's call-in shows. We'll be on for the next 2 hours. Let's see, I first want to say thanks to Phil Innes, the host for the last 2 hours. Great show there. And Jonathan is off island. I think he's over in Europe somewhere for the next 6 weeks, so we won't see him for a little bit. But we got a good show lined up for you. And I need to tell you, this is KKCR Honolulu, KAQA Kilauea Kauai Community Radio. And this show is brought to you by these wonderful underwriters.
Alaheo Wellness Center, natural pain relief services, providing gentle chiropractic, acupuncture, therapeutic massage, nutritional wellness, electromagnetic cellular therapy, and spinal rehab. Most major health insurance plans and Medicare accepted. Open Monday through Friday, 332-5580 or online at kalaheochiropractic.com.
HawaiiGaga.com, Hawaii Vacation Rental Directory and Vacation Guide. A proud sponsor of Kauai Community Radio, Hawaii Gaga also publishes the Kauai GPS Tour Guide, an audio tour of Kauai for iPhones. More information online at HawaiiGaga.com.
It's the 13th annual Heiva'i Kauai Yorana Tahiti, August 2nd and 3rd at Kapa'a Beach Park. Gates open at 9 a.m., opening ceremony at 9:30. 2 days of solo dance, group dance, and drumming competitions with Polynesian artists. Cultural demonstrations, crafts, silent auction, and island foods. This year features a special guest group, To'a Huhina from Tahiti, performing the exciting dances of the Marquesas Islands, and dance exhibitions by Oahu's award-winning Te Wai Ura Nui. Workshops are open to the public for all levels. Sponsored by HTA and County of Kauai. For ADA or more information, call 822-9447 or online at heiva'ikauai.com.
Announcing the 29th Annual Kaloa Plantation Days, July 18th through the 27th, celebrating Kauai's plantation roots for 10 days with a wide variety of fun and interesting activities for the whole family. The festival culminates with a parade in Kaloa Town on Saturday, July 26th, featuring horseback and walking units, floral floats, vintage cars, and decorated vehicles in a great hometown parade. Celebrating the workers' camps in plantation towns, followed by the park celebration featuring local favorites Frank De Lima and Augie T, hula by Halau Kale Mokihana Olena Ala, tsunami taiko drumming, and Ledward Ka'apana and Mike Ka'ava. More information about the entire festival online at KaloaPlantationDays.com.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Well, that's right. Okay, well, welcome to the show. And today is July 24th, 2014, for the record. And we have a very special guest here for at least the first half of the show. It's a gentleman who used to be on regularly, but hasn't been on for a couple of years. He's from over in Oahu. His name is Michael Rivero from the website whatreallyhappened.com. And so I wanted to bring him on here because we've got a number of really important and serious events going on around the world, and I wanted to get Michael's perspective on it and the perspective of the many bloggers and websites and news aggregators that are assembled on that website. So Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am, Dave.
Okay, you're coming in really good here. Can you hear us all right?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so the reason I called you in is because it's been quite a while, and I check your website regularly, and I find it to be very informative. And I wanted also to present a different viewpoint than you'll see on the mainstream media on a number of issues, and the way that you cover them is quite a bit different than you'll see here in the news. And so I think our listeners here will benefit from that experience, and perhaps even they can check your website on it. So just a little background then. So your website, whatreallyhappened.com, has gotten to be very popular. It's one of the top 10 news sites in the country now, isn't it? Is it still?
Yeah, it still is, and it's growing. We have a global readership, something like 3 million a month now. Our articles, the original articles, of course, are picked up and echoed in a lot of other sites around the world. It's really hard to get a feel for the reach, but we're definitely getting out there and we're having an impact.
3 million hits a month? That's pretty big. So let's see. Also, you have a radio show. So you've started doing that a couple of years ago. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I started back in 2007 with the Genesis Communication Network. I've gone to a couple of other networks, but as of this week, I'm back with Genesis Communication. And my show is Monday through Friday from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Central Time, which works out to about 10 o'clock in the morning to 1 in the afternoon here in Hawaii. I'm still getting used to the new time slot. But on the mainland, it's a drive time evening slot, and we're doing very well there.
But that's on the Internet? Or is it?
It's on the Internet. We've got AMFM affiliates. We're up on the Cumulus satellite for people who want to download and rebroadcast. And we're certainly the darling of the Part 15 amateur transmitters all across the country.
Okay, so drive time's not exactly the same for Internet website than it is for broadcast radio, though, is it?
Well, yeah, but we do have broadcast affiliates who are carrying the show.
Oh, okay. Well, cool. Well, congratulations. Well, what do you attribute your success there to? Anyway, I mean, why have you become so popular?
Well, because I've been doing this for a little over 20 years now. I started blogging before the word had even been invented, and over the 20 years, I basically built a reputation for good analytical thinking and getting at the facts, not getting into a great deal of hype and. Not getting off into some of the kooky stuff like chemtrails and so forth, and really just sticking to the facts of what's going on with our political system, our economy, and more recently, obviously, trying to derail this rush to war before it really gets out of hand.
Right, and somebody out there is itching for a war, it seems like. You know, over the last just couple of years, between North Korea, Iran, Syria, now Ukraine, you know, Libya and a lot of Arab countries in between, somebody is just itching to start a big major conflict in the world. And fortunately, it hasn't taken. I mean, a lot of minor conflicts around, but no big conflagrations have happened yet. So a lot of people attribute that to the Internet, you know, and to websites like yours and getting the real information out and not letting the propaganda from the government just drown out the truth.
Well, certainly the aftermath of the invasion of Iraq and the claim that Saddam had nuclear weapons has been a bit of a wake-up call for the American public that, yes, indeed, the government will lie to try and start wars. And it's brought an increase in scholarship into previous instances, such as torpedoes in the Gulf of Tonkin, Spanish mine in Havana Harbor. The Lusitania was, in fact, carrying military cargo when it was sunk by the U-boat. And I think the American people are finally beginning to realize that most of these wars, if not all, are started with some kind of a fraud. It's not unique to the United States. Of course, Adolf Hitler sent his own people dressed in Polish clothing to attack the German radio station in Gliwice to frame on the Polish population in order to launch the invasion of Poland, which, of course, was the main trigger of World War II. So a lot of people really have become what I would call a very healthy degree of skepticism toward what they're seeing coming out of the government and the corporate media. Just about a year ago, of course, John Kerry and Barack Obama were out there trying to claim that Syria's President Bashar al-Assad had carried out a chemical weapon attack against his own people, virtually in front of United Nations chemical weapons inspectors on the very day they arrived, and they were out there pushing this very hard. And I advise my readers and listeners to find out if what you're being told is the truth, to always look for what should be there and isn't. And certainly in the case of this claim about Assad, what should have been there and wasn't was a reason for him to do something that stupid. There really was no motive. The same thing earlier in this week when we were seeing all this screaming that Russia had shot down Malaysian Flight 17. Okay, you think that's what they did. Why would they do something like that? And usually that is where a lot of these illusions and hoaxes will fall apart is they're not really complete, and there's always a missing component which advertises the fact that you're dealing with some kind of a propaganda to get the wars going. And certainly the history of the United States over the last 13, 14 years is one of unending intrusion, either overtly or covertly, into countries that are trying to break away from the U.S. dollar, break away from Bretton Woods and the petrodollar deal. And unfortunately, all of this rush to war really comes down to a very simple financial base, and that is preserving the role of the U.S. dollar as the global trade and banking currency against the increasing encroachment of the ruble and the yuan.
Right. And so as we go through these issues, and I want to take several of them one at a time here, I want to focus to some extent on the media aspects of them, how it's portrayed in the mainstream media, how, you know, in some cases, the Internet media has provided better information, I think, to the American people. And so that's one of the things I want to kind of cover as we go through some of these issues. The first one I want to start talking about here then is in the Ukraine. Okay, and if we look at how this incident started, I guess it was probably 6 months or so ago, beginning of the year, when there was a U.S. and NATO overthrow of the government, where they hired a big group of people to act as protesters, come out there and get rid of the Tymoshenko. Is that the previous president of Ukraine? Got rid of him. There was the and we found out since that the Western powers hired that group of protesters, and also there was the sniper incident, which killed about 100 people in Maidan Square, and it turned out that the West was responsible for that incident also, even though they tried to pin that on the previous administration. And so, you know, that information has not been in the mainstream media, and they're now portraying Russia as the aggressor in that whole situation. But you have kind of debunked that to a large extent, I think, in your coverage.
Well, I and a lot of other people as well. Obviously, it's a team effort here. And you're absolutely right. Last January, Ukraine's elected government rejected an offer to merge with the European Union, probably because they're looking at those European nations that are already a part of the European Union and how badly they are faring economically under the European Central Bank, which is a privately owned central bank like the Federal Reserve, like the World Bank, like the IMF. And so Ukraine decided they were going to go with an offer from Russia, which was far more attractive. And it's at that point the U.S. And the European Union set up this covert overthrow to force the elected government of Ukraine from power by force, and they put in this junta, which said, yes, we will shackle our economy to the European Union, we're going to do all of our business with the Union, and we'll kick Russia out of the bases in Crimea. Then, of course, the people of Crimea were looking at what was going on in Kiev and said, look, we did not elect this government. They're making decisions which we think are very poor for the Ukrainian people in our country. They held a referendum to declare their independence, which under the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights is the right of any people on earth to change their government, self-determination. Then they had another referendum and said, can we join Russia? And Russia said, sure, come on board. And at that point, the United States began to get very, very upset because we were seeing these other eastern Ukrainian regions start to break off and declare themselves independent republics. This was a real problem for the European Central Bank because most of the wealth generation capability in Ukraine is in that eastern sector where all the heavy manufacturing is. So Poroshenko basically went out and said, we are not going to let any more portions of our country break off and merge with Russia. And that basically is the origin of the civil war. And it's almost a self-defeating, if you will, a pyrrhic victory, because in the process of trying to bring the independent republics back into Ukraine, Poroshenko is destroying that industrial base in the eastern Ukraine that he's going to need to try and repay all these new debts from the IMF and the European Central Bank.
Right. Well, the eastern half of the Ukraine is at least 75% Russian-speaking, Russian ethnic population. They were part of Russia for as long as they can remember until about 15 years ago or something like that, when the USSR broke up. And so they still have a lot of ties with Russia. Their families are all throughout Russia. And so they feel closer to, you know, the Russian Federation than they do to the Europeans. And so, you know, now back to the part about Crimea. Now, is Crimea part of Russia now? I mean, is that official, or are they still an independent nation at this point, or republic?
No, they have officially aligned with the Russian republics. Russia's building a brand new bridge across to make sure that transportation logistics are able to reach Crimea if Ukraine cuts off the other remaining highways that are coming down from Ukraine itself. However, those highways are pretty much out of the control of Kiev and under the control of the Eastern Ukrainian republics. But obviously, infrastructure is important. Russia's laying some new gas pipelines to try and prevent interruption in supply there. In a lot of ways, it's almost like a repeat of the old Soviet Union when they tried to blockade West Berlin to force them to merge with the Soviet Union. And I think Russia is still concerned that Ukraine, Europe, and the U.S. might come back and try and grab Crimea, because that was a major prize of this whole overthrow of Ukraine's government, because Crimea represents the only warm water seaports the Russian Navy has. And the U.S. agenda going in there was for the new puppet regime in Kiev to kick Russia out of those seaports.
Just to deny them that access
to the deny them access to the Black Sea, access to warm water seaports. It would have been a tremendous restriction on Soviet naval power. Russia was never going to go along with that comfortably. And that, of course, is when the situation really, really started to heat up. But there's a larger issue going on here, and that is that after World War II, the model of literally marching into another country and taking it over militarily sort of became passé. People didn't want to deal with that. So for the U.S. to expand its influence, it adopted a new strategy of covertly overthrowing governments in other countries and replacing them with sympathetic regimes who would serve U.S. commercial interests.
To make it look like they're indigenous uprisings rather than, brought up by the outside, the West.
Exactly, exactly. And since the end of World War II, the United States has tried to covertly change the government of a little over 50 nations, succeeding 26 times. Some of the well-known successes would be Iran in 1953, Chile in 1973. I think it's too soon to say whether this overthrow of Kiev can be counted a success or not. Some of the better-known failures are when they tried a second coup in Iran in 2009, and that one pretty much fell flat on its face. But this is the model. Venezuela, they were in there. They did succeed in ousting him once, but he came right back. But this is the model, and this is the reason the United States has become hated around the world, because of this bad habit of going in and tinkering with other people's countries, tearing down elected leaders and elected representatives and putting in what amount to dictators to basically strip the nation of its mineral wealth, shackle it, align it to the U.S. dollar, and basically turn it into, if you will, a province of the new American empire.
Right. I want to let the listeners know that the phone lines are open and will be open for the entire show. So we will take your calls at 826-7771 if you've got calls for Michael Rivero on any of the issues that we're dealing with here or anything you want to ask him about. 826-7771. We'll try and fit you in as the discussion allows. So it's been a couple of weeks now since the Malaysian airliner went down. And within hours, the United States was blaming Russia and Putin for that, you know, Putin's missiles, and they started putting additional sanctions on Russia. And there was a lot of disinformation out at that time. And there still is, I think, to a large part, but they're starting to sort out and say, well, maybe it wasn't the Russians, but, you know, somehow they're responsible. So I guess I attribute some of that turnaround to the internet, people posting information on the internet and saying, you know, that discussion between those two, rebel generals was posted before the plane ever came down, or that picture of that rocket launcher is not in eastern Ukraine, it's from a different area. And so, you know, as the U.S. government throws out information and says, look, hey, this proves Russia did it, you know, it's getting debunked daily on the internet. And so that's kind of a new development in world information exchange, I think. Do you see that?
You're absolutely right there. I mean, the Internet and the independent media have changed the fundamental nature of information flow in our society as dramatically as Gutenberg did when he rediscovered movable type printing. And we see a lot of parallels between the reaction of our society to the availability of the Internet and how society responded to Gutenberg when books became affordable to the middle class, literacy exploded, people had access to information that was not being given to them by the rulers and the clergy, and some of the institutions were able to adapt to this new reality, and they're still with us. Other institutions couldn't adapt to that change, and they went extinct, and we're going to see a lot of that happening now in the present age.
Okay, so at this point, we still don't know who shot down the plane. It could have been an air-to-air missile, because we now know the Russians have provided satellite information to show that the Ukrainian fighter jets were flying right parallel with it, and that they normally or routinely will track along with commercial aircraft to kind of hide their signal so that they can bomb deeper into the country without getting caught by radar or something like that. So it could have been a Ukrainian fighter jet that shot it down. It could have been Ukrainian government from Kiev who shot it down, made it look like it was Russians or the separatists. But at this point, we still don't know who fired the missile or where it came from. Is that right?
No, we really don't. There's a lot of fine details to work out, but we do know that, and Malaysian Airlines and the Malaysian government have confirmed this, Ukrainian air traffic control diverted that plane some 200 kilometers north of its normal safe corridor to fly it over that area. And we do know that this piece of propaganda that was trying to prove that the rebels shot it down actually hit the Internet before the shootdown actually happened. So it does look like we're dealing with a false flag, and it looks to me like Poroshenko decided he was going to shoot down the civilian airliner, blame it on Russia, blame it on the Russian separatists to try and turn world opinion against them. That appears to have pretty much failed at this point, with the exception of the American media. The rest of the world is saying, yeah, this just reeks of being somebody's dirty trick to fan up the flames. And it appears to have had a consequence within Ukraine's government itself, because on the very day of the shootdown, there was literally a brawl in the Ukrainian parliament. I mean, fist fights, people throwing chairs at each other. And, of course, earlier today, the prime minister and cabinet resigned, and the coalition government has essentially crumbled. So Poroshenko at the moment is operating without a complete legal government in Kiev. And it looks like a lot of people inside the Kiev government got very spooked by what was going on, and they're basically leaving the sinking ship.
So perhaps the assault on eastern Ukraine is perhaps been lifted for the time being. You know, if they're in disarray in the government, they certainly can't be supporting a war in eastern Ukraine. So I would...
Well, that would be kind of nice. We know there's a lot of hired mercenaries in there, because the Ukrainian troops themselves are very resistant to shooting at their own fellow citizens, relatives, friends. We know there have been a huge number of defections from the Kiev forces over to the independent republics. So we know that there are Polish mercenaries on the ground there, and they're probably going to keep on going on the basis of their existing orders as long as the paychecks keep coming in. I'd like to see this settle down, but certainly from the United States point of view, they have a very urgent reason to try and get into a situation of conflict with Russia. Whether or not they actually fight the war, what they're trying to do is to get back into sort of this confrontation, a renewal of the Cold War, because the real agenda behind all of this nonsense is the global trade and banking currency. And if I may take a few minutes, I'll give you some background.
Sure,
on
go
that.
Ahead.
All right. Now, Roosevelt's price to bring the U.S. into World War II was for Winston Churchill to surrender the British pound sterling's role as the then global trade and banking currency. So at the end of World War II, all of the world's financial powers got together at this luxury resort in New Hampshire called Bretton Woods, and they hammered out the Bretton Woods Agreement. This is the agreement that made the dollar the global trade and reserve currency. This brings a tremendous financial advantage to the United States financial sector, to Wall Street, because before anybody can do any business across borders, they have to first come to the United States and bring manufactured goods or agricultural produce to trade for those ink and paper notes, or they have to borrow those notes at interest from the Federal Reserve. Then they go on about their business. And this means the United States has this tremendous economic advantage. It's like the mafia and a piece of the action. No matter what anybody's doing across borders around the world, the U.S. financial system makes a profit on that. And over the last 30 years especially, the financial system of the United States got kind of lazy. All this money was coming in from Bretton Woods, and they allowed our manufacturing to decline, our agriculture to decline. The United States is now a net importer of food. And as a result, they're now dependent on the continuation of Bretton Woods and the dollar as the global trade and reserve currency. But there have been a couple of hiccups along the way. See, when Bretton Woods was signed, everybody else went along with it on two conditions. First, that the United States not simply overprint dollars in order to loot other nations of manufactured goods and agriculture.
Oops.
And second, that the dollar would always be redeemable for gold at $35 an ounce. So far, so good. Well, of course, the Federal Reserve, which is not actually a part of the government, they're no more federal than Federal Express, did overprint the U.S. dollars and started sending them all over the world in exchange for manufactured goods and agricultural produce. And it was part of the post-war boom time that we enjoyed here in the United States in the 1950s. Then we get to 1970, and France is looking at in their bank vaults, and they're seeing these huge, huge piles of ink and paper from the United States, and they notified the administration of Richard Nixon they were going to exercise their option to redeem those paper notes for gold at $35 an ounce. Richard Nixon took a look in the gold vaults, realized they didn't have anywhere near enough gold to redeem all that paper, and he ended gold convertibility, supposedly as a temporary emergency measure, but of course it was permanent to this day. That was the end of the gold standard. Well, along with basically stiffing France and a lot of other people who had had those paper notes, it created another problem in that the U.S. had been claiming to hold a huge amount of gold, part of which was pledged as collateral on U.S. government borrowing from other nations. Now, all of a sudden, other countries were starting to wonder if that collateral was really there. So Richard Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency, but it was not really about the environment. They set up all these programs like heritage rivers, wilderness zones, roadless areas, wetlands, and started confiscating public and private land and locking it away. And this became the new collateralization for continued government borrowing. All of this a violation of what's called the Enclave Clause in the Constitution, which says the federal government is only allowed to own land underneath federal buildings and military bases. But that's basically why the government has been grabbing up all this land out in Nevada, down in Texas. It's the new collateral for the U.S. government's borrowing. And now, that is basic. Go ahead.
Now, that's not something that's commonly known or believed there. How can we check that? What information? What sources do we have on that sort of information?
There are
national parks and everything like that. You know, there is federal land, but... But how do we know it's been collateralized and maybe even given to other countries?
It hasn't been given to the other countries yet, but the problem is when the U.S. economy crashes, there are going to be these other countries coming in and saying, hey, we were pledged this chunk of land as collateral on borrowing. Now, at that point, I would suggest everybody look up odious debt, which is a recognized principle in international law that says what debts of a former government the people are responsible for, and more importantly, what debts they're not liable for. Usually money borrowed for war, money borrowed for oppression of the people, money borrowed to give away as gifts is not considered the valid debt of the people. And this principle has been used by populations to erase and repudiate debts imposed upon them. So getting on back to the collateralization issue, there are a number of online resources for it, including one at my website, which I will put up on the main page for people to check out when the show is over. But that was really what was going on with that situation. But with America's decline in manufacturing and agriculture, especially in the wake of this disastrous experiment with GMOs, people trading in dollars around the world began to realize that if they took a paper dollar in trade and brought it back to the United States of America, there really wasn't much they could get for it that they would want. I mean, our manufacturing is to the point where we can't even make a reliable ignition switch on a car. Our once vaunted military development centers are producing disastrous products like the F-22, the F-35, those independent class littoral ships which are seen basically as overpriced junk.
Isn't that the Super Ferry?
And the Super Ferry.
Yeah, that was a military littoral ship.
Well, I'm talking about the Independence-class ship, which is so badly designed, the first ones put into service already had to have a huge section of the hull replaced due to corrosion. Apparently, somebody over in the Navy Yard forgot about zinc sacrificial anodes. But you have China and Russia, which are major manufacturing centers, and they've got good agriculture, and their currencies are seen as very stable. They're not being inflated out of control by their equivalent of quantitative easing here in the United States of America. So you have the BRICS nations, which are Brazil, Russia, India, China, and I forget what the S one is supposed to be for. But they are now a body of 80 nations which are setting up a parallel global financial system that does not go through the dollar. And this represents a major threat to the U.S. financial centers because they are dependent on that Bretton Woods piece of the action of global commerce. And it really is reaching the danger point because we have nations like Great Britain and Canada, which are now engaging in direct currency exchanges with China without going through the dollar. It does represent a threat. And I'll tell you how important this is and how it links into the wars. In 2002, Saddam Hussein got permission from the United Nations to sell Iraq's oil, not for the U.S. dollar, but for the euro. And this was a major threat to what was called the petrodollar deal.
Now, and we know what happened to him.
Well, I'm going to get to that in a little bit. When following Nixon's closing of gold convertibility, the U.S. government went out to all the oil nations of the world, mostly OPEC, and they said, we'll make you a deal. As long as you sell your oil only for U.S. dollars and invest that money in the United States, we will militarily protect you from your enemies, meaning Israel. And this petrodollar deal kept up international demand for the dollar, even in the growing awareness that the U.S. couldn't back up those paper notes with gold or products or agriculture. So one of the downsides of Israel's increased aggression against their neighbors is these other nations in the area are realizing the U.S. can't keep their half of the petrodollar deal. So in 2002, Saddam Hussein goes to the United Nations. He gets their permission to sell Iraq's oil for the euro. 1 year later, screaming weapons of mass destruction, the United States invades Iraq. They lynch Saddam Hussein, and they put Iraq's oil back on the world market, but only for the U.S. dollar. Then we have Libya, where Muammar Gaddafi was really working at making Libya a better place to live. He got rid of their private central bank. He set up a state central bank to handle the public currency as a public utility. He introduced a value-based currency called the gold dinar, and then he announced that anybody who wanted to buy Libya's oil would have to pay for it with the gold dinar. The U.S. invades, they get rid of the state bank, they put in a private central bank, the gold for the gold dinar has vanished, nobody knows where it's gone, and Libya's oil is back on the market, but only for U.S. dollars.
And the very first thing that they did in Libya before the bullets even started flying, was to open up a European central bank in that country.
That's exactly right, because that is the means by which the money junkies keep control over nations. And what is really ironic is this kind of banking, it's very predatory. It's the very system of banking the United States fought the revolution to be free of. And I know in our public schools they talk about the T-Tax and the Stamp Act and the rest of it, but the reality is that what triggered the American Revolution was King George III passing the Currency Act, which ordered the colonies to stop using their own government-issued money and conduct all commerce using banknotes borrowed at interest from the Bank of England. And it took only a couple of years after this bill was passed for the colonies to be plunged into the same poverty and mass unemployment that you saw in Britain at the same time. And if you read the writings of Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, it's very clear it was that bank predation that triggered the anger that led to the American Revolution. Unfortunately, 100 years ago, we had a corrupt Congress and a corrupt president sell us back into that very same system of banking, and at that point, the public schools stopped mentioning King George III's Currency Act. And we got a new version of the revolution based on tea in Boston Harbor and Paul Revere and these other popular images.
And that was the Federal Reserve Act of 1913.
Absolutely.
Okay, so again, phone lines are open, 826-7771, if you want to join this conversation. So Now, the Ukraine then ties into this because they want to bring as many countries and their resources into the fold to shore up the failing economies of the West, for the most part.
That is exactly what is going on here. And when Ukraine's government rejected the offer to merge with the EU and said they wanted to align with Russia, that's when the U.S. and the EU, they send in these front groups, Canvas, USAID, that basically kick up riots and protests and force the elected government from power and install this junta willing to make war on their own people to serve these financial interests.
Okay, I got a question for you then. What do you think of Vladimir Putin? What is your perception of him, and is he a good guy? He's on the wrong side. Where is how is history going to judge Vladimir Putin?
I think history is going to judge Vladimir Putin as the one world leader who was trying to keep the situation under control. And again, we go back to a year ago last August, where we had Obama and Kerry screaming that Assad was gassing his own people. We have to go and invade. We have to take Assad out. We have to put a U.S.-friendly government in. And Putin came in and said to Assad, look, you're not using these chemical weapons anyway. Let's destroy them. And Assad said, yeah, that's a good idea, and literally pulled the rug out from under the U.S. attempt to take their covert attempt to overthrow Syria and morph it into an overt, outright invasion.
So
and at that point...
Now, part of that occurred, John Kerry blurted this out in a press conference. You know, they said, is there anything Syria could do to avert a U.S. invasion? He said, well, maybe if they gave us chemical weapons, we might consider it. And then they said, okay, sure. I mean, was that a serious offer? Was that a mistake on his part or what?
That was definitely a mistake on his part, because the issue was never the chemical weapons. The issue is wanting to get Assad out and get a U.S.-friendly regime in. And it's a continuation of a policy that we have seen being followed. Again, going back to, they tried to do it in Iran in 2009. They tried to do it in Venezuela. And this is the way the United States has been operating since the end of World War II. They've hit some major roadblocks, and it looks to me like this agenda to force the world back to Bretton Woods and the petrodollar is already pretty much failing. Unfortunately, the forces who are behind this agenda, in particular the financial forces, really don't see that they have any choice but to continue pushing this forward, trying to basically make war on any nations that are selling their resources for currencies other than the dollar, any nations that refuse to be part of the Bank of International Settlements and the IMF. And it's a small and shrinking list, but we do have this parallel organization, the BRICS nations.
Right, that's another thing I want to discuss, too. So that's a very important new development.
Yeah, it really is, because there are roughly 80 nations now aligned with BRICS. If they were all at the same time to decide to drop using the dollar, the party would definitely be over. And I think it's because picking nations off piecemeal hasn't been working, that the U.S. has decided now's the time to get into a state of war with Russia and China in order to force all of our allies to not use the ruble, not use the yuan, continue using the U.S. dollar, so that the U.S. financial system can continue to profit from that Bretton Woods arrangement.
Right. So the BRICS Bank just opened it. Putin was just in South America last week, and they funded it originally for $50 billion, but not in U.S. dollars, but in rubles and yuan and, you know, their indigenous currencies of the member countries. And so that takes that much of the economy out of the U.S. dollar. So that's
it. Yeah, it really does. Now, at the end of World War II, when transactions were still being settled with stacks and stacks of paper notes, having a single global currency did make some kind of sense. But in the 21st century, in an age of instantaneous global financial transactions, there really isn't a need for there to be a single global currency. It's being maintained and promoted only because whoever owns that global currency is going to make a huge amount of money from all those other nations that have to come and acquire that currency before they do business.
Now, they've floated possible means of going around the U.S. dollar, replacing it with something else, special drawing rights from the IMF or something like that. I'm not really sure what those are and how they relate to a currency, but I've seen where they're trying to replace the U.S. dollar with something different, but basically sounds the same to me.
Well, anytime you're dealing with the IMF, yeah, right now the owners and operators of all these private central banking scams are trying to figure out a way where they can repackage what they've been doing and make it look attractive enough for people to go back into that situation. But I think at this point, people around the world are looking at what happens to every single nation with a private central bank, because in the long run, they're plunged hopelessly into debt. They wind up taking extreme measures like we saw in Cyprus, where the banks are simply stealing from savings accounts to keep themselves going. Now they're talking about it even here in the United States of America and all over Arizona, because it is a pyramid scheme, and they all eventually collapse. And because of globalism, this time the collapse could be total across the entire private central banking system. And I think while it would be certainly uncomfortable for a couple of months to get through that, I think the time has come for the human race to abandon that private central banking model and go back to government currency, a public currency that's handled as a public utility, which is how the United States started and became immensely prosperous. And the bankers don't like that. They don't like the idea of a government or people furnishing their own money without being an obligation to the bank. And they have throughout history engaged in assassination, coup d'etat, and wars to maintain this little system of control over the population. Because you need to understand that private central banking, it isn't science. It's actually closer to a religion. It's an arbitrary set of beliefs we're all brainwashed into believing represents something real through which we are looted of our work product and our wealth and controlled by these bankers. It's ruled by compound interest, and it's no more legitimate a form of governance than two previous systems, ruled by divine right and ruled by slavery. And like those previous systems, it only works only as long as people are willing to believe this is how the world is supposed to be. But more and more people are beginning to wake up and realize there is a different way to run a nation's economy, the way the United States started with back in the 1790s.
Well, also, the net result of this system, having been in place for at least 100 years, probably longer, is that 1% of the population owns 50% of the planet, and most of the rest of the people are destitute, in poverty. And so
that's exactly what the system does.
That's what it does. That's what it's designed to do. It's working.
And yeah, and it is, and it's almost completed, but eventually it reaches a point of collapse, and at that point they start going to these extreme measures of declaring bank customers are unsecured investors in the bank and therefore must share the losses. And it's all just a lot of fancy talk to basically cover up the fact that as the banks get into trouble from this system, they're going to dump the losses onto you. They're going to take the surplus money from your savings account. Basically, that means we are in a fascist economic state. And I know there's a lot of people who want to believe the United States is capitalist, and it used to be, but it really isn't anymore. And let me give you three definitions here. Capitalism is a system in which if you make money, you get to keep it. And if you lose money, you are responsible for that debt, and you have to live with it, because freedom means not only the freedom to succeed, but the freedom to fail and the responsibility to accept either outcome. Now, socialism or communism is a system in which if you're making lots of money, it's taxed away from you for society. If you lose money, society is taxed to cover the losses so you can pick up and start again. Fascism, which Mussolini said should be more appropriately called corporatism, is a system where if you make a lot of money, you get to keep it, and only if you lose money is society taxed to cover the losses. And after all these years of bailouts and TARP and all the rest of these actions we've seen by Washington, D.C., that take money away from the American people and shower it all over Wall Street, it's very clear we're not capitalist any longer. We have degenerated into a fascist economic state. And it's almost laughable when you have the Occupy Wall Street protests out there and the corporate media was saying they're opposed to capitalism. And it's absolutely not true. They're opposed to fascism. They want to go back to capitalism. And, you know, all of this fancy language they use to obfuscate what they're doing, bailout, for example, all a bailout is taking $1 trillion from the American people and giving it to the banks so the banks can then loan it back to the American people at interest, which is a great deal for the banks and not really very good for the American people.
Right. And the system does seem to be kind of unraveling at the edges here, and a lot of people are predicting a big correction here soon. But when it gets to be a desperate situation like that, people will accept you know, things that they wouldn't normally accept. If you say that, okay, the dollar is no good anymore, so we have this other bill here that you can use and everything is fine, they'll just jump on that. But if you say, you know, that there are alternatives, let's discuss them, you know, they might pick something different. So in a desperate situation, people will just go with the status quo or whatever they offer to the people. I mean, I see a lot of scared people who don't know what to do and will accept whatever the government tells them at that point without really thinking it through.
Well, there's always going to be a segment of the population who's just going to go along, and even though the government lied to them and messed up the economy, they'll go back to the government and say, yes, I'll forgive you, let's try again. But the success of forcing a new version of private central banking on us rests on the government being able to maintain a monopoly of information flow, and they already lost that capability. And so we have people who are looking at Bitcoin. We have people who are looking at silver and gold. A lot of people are buying up those pre-1965 silver U.S. coins to use as an interim money system. Going back to examples that we saw during the Depression in the 1930s or even the American Civil War, we have communities that are already starting to create their own internal value-based non-borrowed currencies. And I think we're going to see a lot of that as the U.S. financial system comes down.
Right. Somebody just called in and asked, how do we get rid of the Federal Reserve? Is there a way of getting rid of that system at this point?
Well,
politically, I guess.
Without resorting to violence, I'm going to have to tell you no. And what I'm always advising all of my readers and listeners is, I know it's very hard, but just stay patient and don't do anything that allows the government to declare a national emergency. It's tearing itself apart at the moment. Our big task is going to be to not let them set a new one up in its place. Now, the reality is that Congress can rescind the charter of the Federal Reserve anytime they want by simply having a vote, and their only obligation under the Federal Reserve Act is to return to the owners of the Federal Reserve the $1 billion that was loaned to the government in order to bring the Federal Reserve into existence. And, of course, these days, $1 billion just isn't a lot of money when the government's throwing trillion here, trillion there, and trillion so forth. The problem is that Wall Street is actually the biggest financial contributor every single election, and nobody in Washington, D.C. wants to anger those bankers, because Wall Street may be the big money junkies, but Washington, D.C. Is a bunch of little money junkies.
Right.
Except for Ron Paul. Ron Paul wanted to end the Federal Reserve.
Hey, we have a caller that would like to go on the air and ask you a question there. Caller?
Okay. Hey, this is Bob Scotland. How are you guys?
Great.
I'm living in Wainiha. Just sold my house and moved. I'm going to go to Italy and have a good time for an 83-year-old guy. But I got this wonderful 6-year-old cat that I don't know what to do. She's a rat or supreme, never bothers outdoors, catches everything, comes up during the day for a little food and stuff, and is gorgeous gray and black with the green eyes. If anybody wants her, please, please, please call me at 431-4724. The most beautiful, nicest cat you'll ever see. And for KKCR, thank you guys very much. It's been a long time I've been listening to you, and you play good jazz, and Vic the Bob is hot. Thanks very much.
All right, thanks for calling. Well, that wasn't exactly directed to you there, was it?
No, it wasn't.
Okay, let's see. I think that's good on that topic there. We've covered that pretty well. The next one I want to move on to is it's what's going on in, well, let's see, we have a phone call. Let's see if somebody wants to address that issue here before we move on to another one. Okay, let's go to the phone. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi. Yes, I had a question for your guest. Did you ask him what his opinion in terms of the long-term post-quantitative easing aspect of our economy it might be?
What happens when they stop the
quantity? Well, in other words, you know, a few years down the road, what does he see some of the options as being?
Well, the problem is that quantitative easing was supposedly started as an emergency measure, but now they're stuck. Every time they've talked about ending quantitative easing or even reducing it, the market takes a major tumble. And that is a problem because part of the program to keep that stock market up so that bankers and the government could point to the Dow and say, see, the economy's really good. We've got a 17,000 Dow, and if you're hungry and homeless and jobless, it's really your own fault, so don't yell at us. And they were buying huge blocks of stock to use market forces to drive the prices up. Well, now that stock is on their balance sheet. And if there is a correction, many of these institutions would be instantly insolvent.
But
so now they can't turn off that quantitative easing.
Isn't it not just equities, sir? It's the fact that they were creating debt, i.e. U.S. treasuries. In other words, we're buying our own debt. So the point is, if every year we've been borrowing from ourselves, but with bad money, bad junk mortgages, for example, $1 trillion a year, whether we go to less, like only $900 million a year in junk, don't you see that down the road that the percentage on the national debt, won't that get to a point where something's going to hit the fan?
Well, I don't think it's down the road. I think it's here. I think we're there. Because you need to understand the way that Federal Reserve System works. There always has to be a larger group of new borrowers to allow the creation of new money, part of which is going to pay the interest on the old money. And they describe it as growth. They use the word growth to make it sound like it's a good thing. The economy is growing. But what that really means is the total aggregate indebtedness of the American people is constantly increasing. And if they can't always find new borrowers, the system starts to come apart here. And so when they first come out with that pretty printed piece of paper and they lend it into circulation and people are borrowing and borrowing until they reach the point where they don't want to borrow anymore because the debt payments and the interest are just using up their wages and salaries. But it's at this point the Keynesian economists will come on in and say government now has to borrow more on behalf of the people, and I might add without their permission, in order to keep the system going.
But isn't there, sir, a threshold, you know, very soon where the percent, the interest on the national debt will get to be so horrendous that, it's all the game over.
We're there. We're there. They're creating new money to pay that old interest. And when they get to this situation is when they try and gin up a world war to try and force everybody to borrow more money to fight the war, to borrow more money to rebuild from the war, and then when this whole scam is over, people like you and I, we have sort of what we had before, except the graveyards are a lot bigger, and we're all back in debt to the banks for another 100 years. Bankers love war.
That's right. They make
the most money off of war.
Don't you think we're in a similar situation to like pre-World War One, like 1914?
Absolutely.
There's
a historical precedent. Crash of 1907, World War One. Crash of 1929, World War Two. Crash of 2008. Look how many nations the U.S. has invaded on two continents. Technically, it's already a world war.
Are you familiar with this book called The Fourth Turning?
Yes, I have.
Well, I mean, the gentleman postulates that studying, U.S. history, that it seemed like every 60 years there's a major depression, regardless of the economic policies of the government.
Yeah, because the economy is not under control of the government. When the government passed the Federal Reserve Act, which, by the way, was unconstitutional, they gave control of the money supply to these private bankers. And the private bankers are controlling the economy for their own benefit. And through that economy, they, in fact, are controlling the government. I've got a video of Alan Greenspan on my website just sitting there and saying the Federal Reserve answers to no federal government authority. They see themselves as above the government in the hierarchy.
I mean, the thing that kills me, sir, is that there's a schizophrenic aspect when you see Mr. Greenspan saying a few years ago, this irrational exuberance. Well, why didn't he come forward and speak more forcefully to this issue?
Well, because he's part of a system that profits from that irrational
exuberance. Exactly.
We're always talking about, like, all these bubbles, like the mortgage-backed securities bubble. And now there's a student loan bubble, and everybody says, well, these are very, very dangerous. But these are the big money makers, because these operators on the inside will deliberately create a bubble. They will ride it to the top, and then on a coordinated signal, they bail out, the bubble collapses, and all the losses go on to the people who showed up too late and aren't part of the country club and get the signal that now's the time to get out. And it's a, it makes huge amounts of money. It provides nothing of benefit to society. And right now, the federal government just looks the other way. They'll wrist slap a few lower level operatives, but they don't want to go after any of the really big bankers because that's going to have a negative impact during the next campaign fundraising season.
My last comment is, what about all these bankers who are committing suicide? Right?
Well, I don't know if there's suicide or if there's a little bit of wet work going on, because we are seeing more and more indications of some massive frauds beginning to surface.
That's what
we
I
already
mean.
Know about the LIBOR scandal. We know that the London Gold and the Daily Gold and Silver Fix was being rigged. They're ending the London Silver Fix next month. They're trying to come up with something else to keep the prices down. And it's looking like there is some monumental fraud going on, certainly with the physical gold bullion. That
all
is
I can
being
say
held.
Is I bought platinum in 1994 at 400.
That's a very good thing for you.
And look where it's at now.
Well, you know, any kind of precious metals, whether it's platinum, silver, gold, tantalum, these are preservers of wealth. It's not that they're getting any more valuable. It's that the dollar is devaluing relative to them. And it's a very, very good idea for anybody who's worried about their financial security to have part of your portfolio in physical silver and gold. Do not buy those gold paper contracts. They're already over-leveraged 100 to 1.
Now, I bought the Canadian platinum coins.
Oh, those got to be. Those have to be gorgeous.
And the thing is, you know, then, of course, you know, the next thing, because platinum can be used both as an industrial metal and for a unit of value. But thank you for your program, and I'll go to your website. Thank you so much, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. That's whatreallyhappened.com. Okay.
Okay, Michael, I need to go to a little station business here. Hang on there, and we'll be right back with you.
Okay.
KKCR, Hale, KAQA, Kilauea, K284AL, Haleiwa.
Aya's Garden, all-natural garden and greenhouse supply. In Kapa'a, down Kukui Street from the Dragon Building. Fertilizers, amendments, soil, seeds, garden and farm organic growing supplies. Open Monday through Saturday. More information at 822-7333 or visit Aya's Garden on Facebook.
Neil Norman and the Hawaii Life Brokerage Ohana proudly supports GMO-free Kauai, agricultural biodiversity, and sustainable farming practices, such as community gardens, food forests, seed saving, and beekeeping. Malama aina.
In the last 6 months, Surfrider volunteers removed over 8 tons of trash, fishing nets, and ropes from Kauai's beaches. The Surfrider Foundation organizes beach cleanups on the fourth Saturday of every month. You can help keep Kauai beaches clean. Join our volunteers on Saturday from 9 to noon on July 26th at New Kaliki Beach. If you see large nets and ropes on the beach, please call our Net Patrol hotline at 635-2593. Help protect our beaches and ocean wildlife. A reminder from the Surfrider Foundation.
The 2014 Kauai Music Festival Concert Series is coming to the Courtyard Marriott Resort in Kapa'a. On Friday, August 1st at 7 p.m. is the Po'alima Concert featuring Hotshell Ray, Merlin Hookman Bonds, Mark Feist, Richard Harris, and more. On Saturday, August 2nd at 7 p.m. is the Pauhana Concert featuring Hawaiian favorites Eric Gilliam, Pandanus Club, John Cruz, and many more. Tickets and outlet locations online at kauaimusicfestival.com. The nonprofit Kauai Music Festival is sponsored in part by Hawaiian Airlines, Alaska Airlines, the Hawaii Tourism Authority, and the County of Kauai.
And mahalo to those folks for supporting Kauai Community Radio. Well, it's 5 o'clock, and you're listening to Out of the Box. I'm your host, Dave Giroux. Jonathan Jay is off-island here for the next couple of shows. He'll be back in about a month or 5 weeks or so. I think he's gallivanting around Italy and Turkey with some friends. Hopefully he's having a good time, and maybe he's even listening in from where he is. I told him to give me a call or a text or something from wherever he is at the time. I haven't heard from him yet. So we got an hour left in the show. phone lines are open at 826-7771. And we're talking with Michael Rivero, who is the host of a website, whatreallyhappened.com, a very popular news aggregation website where he just takes news stories from all over the world and posts them on a single blog format, so you can kind of see what's going on all over the world and hopefully get some information that is not presented in the mainstream media or lamestream media, however you look at it. I believe in large part, you know, this sort of website is, you know, has brought out a lot of important information and has been kind of a thorn in the side of the powers that be and those that are trying to wreak havoc in the world and those that are trying to benefit at your expense. So so I think this is a very important type of a service that he's doing, and we brought him on the air to kind of get his perspective on a number of very important news items that are happening in the world right now.
That's a very good question.
Okay, we have somebody on the phone here.
Okay.
Let's see. Nope, does not want to go on the phone on the air, but does he have a question?
The question is about the prediction for real estate investments.
The prediction for real estate investments. Let's see. I believe Michael will be back here in a moment.
Well, I'm back.
Oh, there you are. Okay,
back.
Great.
I'm here.
Did you hear the question then? What is the prediction for real estate investment in the U.S. or Kauai? I don't know. Hawaii, if you have any insight.
It's kind of hard to be an accurate prognosticator here, but we know that there are reasons why certainly governments and the mortgage bank companies want housing prices to be as high as possible, because the mortgage companies will make more interest loaning you the money, and obviously the higher the value of the property, the higher the property taxes themselves will be. So there's always that upward force on the housing prices. If you could buy a house and pay it off in 5 years like a car, then you are of no more use to the banks. So we're seeing this constant effort to try and churn housing prices up until it reaches the point where people just really can't get in there and buy the houses anymore. And in fact, the numbers for June are that new housing starts really took a major dip this last month. So like anything else, it tends to go in cycles. Like anything else, it tends to be manipulated for the gain of the bankers and the mortgage companies. Certainly investing in a primary residence is a good idea, but as we saw back in 2008, a lot of people got sucked into the frothing of the real estate market. And some made a huge amount of money very quickly, but most of the people wound up owning properties they couldn't sell, on which there were huge, gigantic mortgages that they couldn't pay, and that's what triggered this whole foreclosure firestorm.
Oh, I guess the caller took that off the air. So right now it seems to be softening up in a lot of parts of the country. Hawaii properties and Kauai also kind of specialty types of markets, you know, they don't really trend necessarily the way the rest of the country does.
Well, we're a very desirable location here. There's a certain cachet to, you know, living in Hawaii, and so we're a little bit more immune to what's going on in America's heartland.
Right, and people trying to escape from that sort of thing will often come here to just kind of get out off the beaten path there. But anyway, another topic I wanted to cover is what's going on in Gaza. This is another situation where the initial reports were not at all what they seemed to be, and there's a lot of disinformation and misinformation in the media. And so the situation, as I recall, I mean, there's obviously it's been going on for many, many decades, if not generations, but there were three Jewish kids that were kidnapped and found dead, so the Israeli government started on this rampage through the West Bank and Gaza and bombing and killing and searching homes and displacing people, and then when the Palestinians fought back from that, they were seen as the aggressors in the situation, and now Israel says, oh, we're just, you know, we have a right to protect ourselves, even though they're the ones that started this whole situation. How do you see what's going on over there right now?
Well, obviously the Palestinians have a right to protect themselves as well. And
well, that's not stated in the media ever. I never hear that.
Well, it is in the foreign media. I mean, the media around the world is very much critical of Israel right now. And, of course, today the United Nations Human Rights Council voted to conduct a war crimes investigation against Israel. There was only one no vote in the entire room, and that is, of course, the United States of America, which unflaggingly supports Israel no matter what Israel wants to do.
Now, why is that? I mean, maybe you can come back to that or something like that.
Yeah, I'll come back to that in a little bit. But let's go back and review that timetable you're talking about. Last month, three Israeli teenagers were kidnapped and then killed over in the West Bank in an area in the control of the IDF. Now, ISIS has already claimed credit for having committed that crime, and even the Israeli media is saying that the suspects named by Israel's government are not part of Hamas. They're part of a group that opposes Hamas and is known for trying to cause trouble for them. But Netanyahu took this incident and said, oh, it's Hamas, I'm going to go after them, and he launched this attack into Gaza. And they're in there using very questionable weapons like flechette rounds. They're bombing the United Nations schools where people are being told to go shelter. And it really is very horrific. We have seen this before. Israel's attitude is they want to take Gaza back. Because back when Ariel Sharon was prime minister, he made this deal with the world where they were going to generously give Gaza back to the Palestinians if the world would ignore the illegal settlements being built in the West Bank. And when that was happening, I predicted on my website and on my radio show, as soon as those settlements are facts on the ground and can't be taken back, Israel is going to take Gaza back. Now, the present tensions that are going on in Gaza go back to 2006, where Israel very graciously said, we're going to allow the Palestinians to have their own elections, and the Gazans elected Hamas as their government. This was not what Israel wanted. Israel had expected the Gazans to vote for Fatah, and the Gazans said, no, Hamas has been doing a good job down here. And that's where Israel really clamped down this starvation blockade, and it is a repeat of what the Soviet Union did to West Berlin, trying to starve a population into surrendering their elected government and accepting proxy foreign rule. And if you remember the blockade of West Berlin, the world leapt in with airplanes of food and water and medical supplies, anything to keep the Soviet Union from starving West Berlin into submission. Of course, today, with Israel doing it to Gaza, the world's attitude, for the most part, tends to be a big shrug of the shoulders, except for these private groups that are trying to run the blockade, for which many of them got killed, if you remember the incident with the Mavi Marmara.
Right.
So Israel is up there with their very latest in U.S.-supplied weapons, and I imagine it's very easy to sit in an F-16 or in a drone control center or a tank just spewing out death at a people that don't have an army, don't have a navy, don't have an air force, are fighting back with bottle rockets cobbled together out of plumbing supplies, and the Israelis think they're really big heroes. But I think most other people are realizing that not since Thermopylae have we seen such courage in the face of overwhelming odds. And world opinion very much is turning against Israel on this. We know that the American media and the American politicians are all out there. Yes, Israel's right, Gaza's wrong. You have to go along with it. But looking at the poll numbers that we're seeing in polls that are not being tinkered with by the NSA, Israel has created a public relations nightmare for itself.
Yeah, now they do this every couple of years. It's like every 2-3 years they bombed Gaza like this. Like just what 2-3 years ago, 1,400 Gazans were killed, mostly civilians and quite a few children. This is no different in that respect. But Israel does seem to be getting a little more protests around the world, a little more repercussions from it. They're not getting away with it.
Even within Israel. Even within Israel, there are protests.
Israel calls
it mowing the lawn. And
right.
What it is, the reason for these periodic bombings into Gaza is to prevent the people of Gaza from building themselves a better life, for building up infrastructure. And Israel has bombed the water supply system in Gaza. They bombed the sewage treatment plant. I guess Netanyahu thinks that Hamas is hiding rockets inside tanks of poop. And when Israel says they're bombing Hamas facilities, they're talking about the ambulances, the fire trucks, the police stations, because Hamas is the elected government of Gaza, and they're trying to build a civil infrastructure like any government would, And this is what Israel is basically destroying right now. And Israel's trying to pretend that they're being humanitarian by dropping leaflets saying, we're going to bomb your home, you need to go someplace else. Then the people go into, like, the United Nations schools, and Israel bombs the schools.
Right. Now, also, about a week ago, there was a peace plan or a ceasefire agreement that Israel and Egypt had hashed out that they offered to Hamas, and they rejected it. And now Hamas is being touted as somebody, you know, it's like, hey, you had an opportunity to stop the bombing here, and you didn't take it. So it's all up to, you know, it's all on you.
This is a classic trick that Israel likes to do. First of all, the ceasefire offer came from Israel. They had Egypt present it to make it look like it was coming from an independent third party. But Israel's offer of the ceasefire was, you give us all your weapons, and we get to go on with the starvation blockade, and we get to block off your seaport, and you don't get any. I mean, Israel doesn't even allow musical instruments in for the students in the Gaza schools. I mean, that is how restrictive this is. Obviously, Hamas is not going to go for that. Hamas's counteroffer was, we'll agree to a ceasefire if you open up our borders, let us use our fishing waters, let us use our seaport, let us go out and make some deals with that natural gas that was found off of our coast. These are all very reasonable things, and for any other country on earth, it's normal life that we would probably take for granted, being able to basically come and go as we want across the border. And this is very reasonable for Hamas and Gaza to want, and Israel's attitude is no, you give us what we want first without any qualifications, and maybe somewhere down the road we'll do something nice for you. But Israel never does, and people are now on to this particular negotiating trip.
Okay, so why does the U.S. cover for Israel so vehemently when it's obvious that, you know, they are the aggressors in this situation, have been for decades, if not generations?
Well, the sad reality is that Israel has managed to grab a tremendous control over the U.S. government. There are very, very few politicians willing to stand up to them. Those that do find themselves very quickly out of a job, Cynthia McKinney being a very good example of that. Certainly, Ron Paul's attitudes toward not only the Federal Reserve but Israel were the reason the GOP went to such extraordinary lengths to make sure that he got nowhere in 2008 and 2012, even though Ron Paul had far more grassroots support than any of the other GOP candidates. We know that one of the biggest problems we have is AIPAC, which is this huge foreign policy lobby in Washington, D.C., and they've got so much power, they're not required to register as a lobby for a foreign government, even though that's their function. They have vast amounts of money to hand out in campaign donations. And they will support members of Congress and candidates for the White House who will do what Israel wants, and anybody who doesn't seem to want to do what Israel wants, they'll pile the money into the opponent to get them out of there. And I remember when I was a kid in grade school and we'd see all the little film strips warning us against communist subversion of the U.S. government, and we were always on guard for communist subversion, and it turns out our government was being subverted. We were just fooled into looking at the wrong direction.
Right. Now, Israelis and also U.S. citizens with dual citizenships with Israel are present throughout the government here, but especially in like the NSA, you know, supposedly a whole Mossad operation, whole Israeli operation. And a lot of the information that they're collecting has been used for blackmailing politicians into voting toward Israel. And I think
I think
I just saw something on your website today where Netanyahu offered Bill Clinton evidence from Monica Lewinsky and says, if you don't release Jonathan Pollard, we're going to break this story. And he didn't take it, and it came out anyway, or it did come out. But
well, he was going to take it, but the head of the CIA threatened to resign if Jonathan Pollard was released, because Jonathan Pollard really inflicted a huge amount of damage on America's nuclear deterrent and on basically intelligence assets that were exposed to Mossad and who wound up being killed. And it was a tremendous, tremendous betrayal, because Israel took that information about our nuclear deterrent. They turned around and traded it to the Soviet Union in exchange for increased immigration quotas for Russian Jews wishing to move to Israel. And this doesn't sound like the behavior of somebody who's supposed to be our only friend in the Middle East. And that's why this is such a horrible scandal. But even before Netanyahu was trying to use the Monica Lewinsky phone sex tapes to get Jonathan Pollard, Israel was blackmailing Bill Clinton with those recordings to have him order the FBI to stop looking for Israel's top agent inside the administration, codenamed MEGA. And Clinton did, in fact, pull the FBI off of that. So Israel just plays this game. They've got monstrous spying capability inside the United States of America. They get the raw take from the NSA spy system without any filtering at all. And that, in and of itself, is a huge, huge scandal. Back when 9/11 happened, there was another story, and actually Carl Cameron at Fox News did a four-part special on this, where there had been a problem with United States drug enforcement authorities unable to carry out successful raids against Israeli drug smugglers who were bringing in things like MDMA, ecstasy into the country. Every time they'd go to do a raid, the target would be gone, and the police began to think that somehow these drug dealers, these Israeli drug dealers, were getting the information about the impending raid. And it led to the discovery that two Israeli companies that are in the middle of America's telecommunications system were acting as spy operations. The first one was Amdocs, which does phone billing for most U.S. phone companies, which gives them access to who is calling who, when, and where. And there was a second company called Converse Infosys, which had the contract to install phone tapping equipment in America's phones. The old days, they'd have to use alligator clips. Today, the eavesdropping capability is built right into the phone system. And this Israeli company had put a backdoor in there where Israel could monitor phone conversations of America's politicians, America's police officers. They were using this information to help their friends who were smuggling drugs. And it turned out when the FBI started to roll up this spy ring, it was the largest foreign spy ring ever uncovered in the United States of America. And, of course, when 9/11 happened, there was this story that kind of came and went where Carl Cameron had a U.S. government official who said there was evidence that linked these arrested Mossad agents to 9/11, but this evidence was being classified by the U.S. government. So there's a very, very dark relationship between the U.S. government and Israel, and certainly ever since 9/11, Israel's arrogance toward the U.S. has gone right through the roof, and I think it's likely to presume that Israel, just as they were blackmailing Bill Clinton with Monica Lewinsky's phone sex tapes, the government of Israel is blackmailing the government of the United States with the truth behind 9/11, where they're going to say, look, do what we say or we'll tell the world what really happened on 9/11, and it'll be bad for us, yes, but they expect that kind of behavior from Israel. It'll be a lot worse for you, the American government, where your population still kind of thinks that maybe you're the good guy.
Right. Hey, we have a caller here I'd like to ask you a question. Join the conversation. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Oh, yes, thanks. Don't you think it's sad that our friends, the Israeli Jews, are acting very similar to their former Nazi tormentors?
Well, I wouldn't say that's true. I mean, the Nazis never bombed their own concentration camps.
Pardon?
That is
one good point I will give you, sir. But I just think it's like I would hate to have the karma of the Israeli Jews in just seeing how they're acting. Don't they ever look in the mirror and just ask these questions?
Well, some do. Let's be very honest.
Some do. Some do.
Let's be honest and fair here. Yes, we have the government of Israel, which is acting in a very brutal, barbaric manner. Yes, we have those Israelis who are down on those hills overlooking the bombardment of Gaza and cheering the way the Romans at the Colosseum did when the Christians were thrown to the lions. But there is a large percentage of the people inside Israel who are not buying into this. There are Israeli human rights groups who are out there trying to find a way to stop it. There have been protests in Tel Aviv about what's going on. Israel's government doesn't have the support of most of the Israeli people, just like the U.S. government no longer has the support of most of the American people.
I agree, but I don't think most Americans are aware that in the 67 war, the USS Liberty was attacked
by the Israeli military killing 142 of our own Navy, and then they tried to, like, basically tried to rope us into the conflict with Egypt, okay? But of course, that was quickly hushed up,
and well, basically, there were 140 crewmen on the USS Liberty. I think only 34 were actually killed.
Oh, well, I'll give you the expertise, sir.
While Israel was trying to sink the USS Liberty, they were jamming all of the Liberty's radio channels,
right,
and at the same time telling President Johnson that Egypt was trying to sink this USS.
Exactly.
And Johnson went along with it, along with McNamara, and there was actually a strike in the air on the way to Cairo to bomb the place when the crew of the Liberty finally got an improvised antenna up and got a message out saying, hey, these are Israelis trying to sink us. They won't even let us abandon ship. They're shooting up the life rafts. They don't want any survivors. And at that point, the whole plot fell apart. But President Johnson didn't want to embarrass Israel, so he sent Admiral John McCain, Senator John McCain's father, over to the Liberty and said, if you guys talk about this, you are going to go away to prison and you will never see the light of day again.
That's right. The
official story became it was cloudy, it was wet, the Israeli pilots have lousy eyesight, they couldn't see the flag. And yet, if you look at the photos and films shot from the Liberty during the attack, it's clear blue skies, scattered clouds. The flag that the Liberty was flying on the day is now on permanent display at the United States Cryptographic Museum. And you can still see the cannon shell holes in it where the Israelis were shooting it up.
Wow. Well, the thing that really kills me is that if you look into the history prior to World War One, you will see that this whole idea of a Jewish homeland in Israel was one of the significant precursors of World War One, and that, you know, Mr. Rothschild and other individuals, you know, were really, and the moneyed powers were really pushing. This is one of the major factors that contributed to World War One.
Oh, absolutely.
And, I mean, the whole thing, I believe, just that, you know, since, of course, JFK, through the CIA, helped create the Mossad, and I think the Jews are, or the Israeli Jews, excuse me, they're really good at getting, you know, dirt on all our politicians, just like you mentioned with Mr. Clinton and all that. So that's why they have such a stranglehold on the U.S. Congress.
One of the reasons there's outright bribery. There are a lot of members of Congress who are of Israeli ancestry or the Jewish faith, and they know where the real money and the real power is, and it's in the hands of these bankers who, like Lloyd Blankfein, are walking around saying, I'm doing God's work, and they're all listening to voices in their head and thinking it's the imaginary playmate in the sky. But first of all, JFK actually didn't start the Mossad. CIA was involved, but they weren't talking to JFK. JFK was very much opposed to Israel's acquisition of nuclear weapons. And so Israel was one of the groups that absolutely did not want to see JFK continue in office. But, you know, John F. Kennedy was kind of a weird situation. Son of a bootlegger, rowdy, wild kid when he was young. But when he got into the White House, it seemed to change him. And all of a sudden he felt like he was going to try and do the job the way he thought it ought to be done. And in the process of that, he made a lot of enemies, because a lot of people had supported him for president expecting favors back. Organized crime had helped him win against Richard Nixon. Then John F. Kennedy put Robert Kennedy as attorney general and sent him after organized crime. Kennedy shut down that oil depletion allowance for the Texas oil billionaires who had been funding him as well. And, of course, there was that whole Bay of Pigs trying to shut down the CIA. But Kennedy's biggest offense was Executive Order 11110, where he used his authority as president to issue what he called the United States Note. This was a parallel currency to the Federal Reserve Note, but it had a difference. It was based on value, and as it circulated through commerce, it wasn't accruing interest to the Federal Reserve. And Kennedy put about $4.5 billion of United States Notes into circulation, and that was a huge, huge threat to the Federal Reserve and its profitability. So 5 months after Executive Order 11110 is when Kennedy was killed in Dealey Plaza, Dallas, Texas. And on the Warren Commission sat John J. McCloy, president of the Chase Manhattan Bank, president of the World Bank, and I don't care how good a banker he is, he's not qualified to be investigating the murder of a president, so he was there to make sure the link between the assassination and the economics of the United States remained hidden. Oh, it's a crazed lone nut in a bookstore. That's all you need to think.
You know, I think that just if you just look at the evidence around 9/11, you can see that obviously, and I may be totally wrong, but I believe from all the evidence that I've seen that someone either in our government or somewhere in the power structure of the United States knew about this plot by maybe the crazy Arab folks, and they just basically played these people, and I believe Israel was behind it.
I think Israel and the United States partnered on this, and
right.
there is no question that the United States knew what was going on. I mean, going back to what Carl Cameron said about there being evidence that linked 9/11 to the Mossad, but that our government had classified it, that's a dead giveaway. But I keep thinking back to George W. Bush on 9/11. He's down in Sarasota, Florida, at the Booker Elementary School reading about pet goats, and Andy Card comes in, whispers in his ear that the second plane has hit the second tower, and at that point, everybody knows the nation is under terror attack. Now, Bush's presence at that school was in the media a week ahead of time. There is, in theory, an unknown number of aircraft flying over the country, crashing into buildings, and there's an airport only 4 miles away from the school. But we don't see the Secret Service grab the president, throw him in that armored limo, the Beast, and start to drive in a random direction to foil a possible inbound. They just stand there and let the president read about pet goats until it's time for him to make his speech. Obviously, President Bush and the Secret Service protective detail knew that Bush was not a target. And the only way they could know that is they knew ahead of time what the targets would actually be. That, to me, is the clincher that says the U.S. government itself was involved in 9/11.
Amen. Well, thank you. Go to your website.
All right, thanks an awful
thank
lot.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Okay, then kind of back to the Gaza situation. Where do you see this going here? I mean, I guess if we just look back at the last couple of times, they'll just create havoc there for another week or so and then stop bombing, and then nothing will change for the time being. Or do you see them trying to occupy Gaza or a portion of it at this point?
I think probably the latter is going to be the case, because every time that Israel has done this to Palestine, it's been a public relations disaster for Israel. I mean, right now, Israel is spending huge amounts of the money they get from the American taxpayer to pay Jewish students to sit at home and post pro-Israel propaganda all over the social media. They openly advertise it. They hand out scholarships to these kids to try and take control of the dialogue on the Internet. It's not working. And we're certainly seeing comments coming out of people in the Knesset that the time has come for Israel to take back Gaza. It's really supposed to be part of Israel all along. And I think they're just going to go for it and clean the place out, shove the Palestinians maybe over to the West Bank, maybe somewhere else. But at this point, what Israel wants is not only the land of Gaza, but that natural gas that was just found off of Gaza's coast. And what's really interesting is Hamas went to Israel and said, look, let's share this. You help us develop the gas. You share in the profit from it. And Israel's attitude is, no, we own it all. We own the entire Eastern Mediterranean and everything that's under it. And I think one of the reasons they kicked off this battle right now is that Russia had approached Hamas about developing that gas field off the coast of Gaza. And I think that is another reason why Israel decided they had to move now on this. And along with the fact that I'm sure that Israel is aware that the U.S. economy is in a very fragile state, and when the big crash comes, Israel is going to lose one of its strongest backers and supporters financially, militarily, even up at the United Nations. Now, they do have others like Canada and the European Union, but the U.S. has really been Israel's champion protector during this whole period of aggression against their neighbors. And I think Israel is sort of looking to a world where the United States isn't just going to be that important anymore.
Right. Well, my heart goes out to the people in Gaza there during this assault. They've got nowhere to go. They're just blocked in. It's a big open-air prison. We have another phone caller. Let's go to the phones here. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Thanks for bringing that correlation between 9/11 and JFK and Israel. I really appreciated that. Where do you see the world in 20 years? Well,
I mean,
can you see that, look at that ahead that far, or maybe more, 5 or 10 years is a better question.
Well, we can go to 20 years. I mean, unfortunately, right now, there are only two possible future courses. One is going to be that the U.S. economy is going to collapse, and we're going to have to get through 4 or 5 months of taking care of each other and form a new nation the way the republics did following the collapse of the Soviet Union. And that's actually the best course, because the other alternative is that if the U.S. gets into a war with China and or Russia, the U.S. is already militarily exhausted. They're economically exhausted. They don't have the manufacturing, the manpower, the money, let alone the moral high ground to prevail in a conventional war against Russia and China. And that means somewhere between the start of that war and final capitulation by the United States government, they will resort to the nuclear weapons. And that's going to be a bad day for anybody not wearing 2 million sunblocks.
Well, I hope we don't get to that situation, but it certainly does look like somebody is pushing us in that direction. Somebody who will likely benefit. I don't know. Obviously, people do benefit from world wars. They have in the past, and they likely will in the future. But I hope it doesn't get to that point. Okay, let's see. It's 5:30. We've got a half hour left in the show. I think we're going to continue talking with Michael Rivero here. And let's see. The next topic I want to talk about, this is something that I don't understand very well, and I don't know if it's just kind of a manufactured situation. But it's something's going on the Mexican border, the U.S.-Mexican border. We first heard about it a couple of weeks ago, or maybe a month or so ago. There were 50,000 children from Honduras and other places in Central America that were housed in detention facilities by the Immigration Service or the Border Patrol. And now they're being moved to different cities and locations around the country. Some are protesting against it. Some are blocking buses. But in the meantime, the border just seems to be open. The border agents are just too busy dealing with all these children that they can't even man their posts. And there just seems to be a flood of immigrants. Or it's just a whole manufactured event, or it's all BS. And I can't really figure out what's going on there. Maybe you have some insight into that.
Well, yes, it's kind of interesting to see President Obama talk about Israel has a right to protect their borders, Ukraine has a right to protect their borders. At the same time, he's left the southern border of the United States wide, wide open. Now, before we get into this, you need to remember that back when Eisenhower was president, he mounted Operation Wetback, and he shut that border down completely with only 10% of the number of border agents that are working down there now. So we know it's possible to shut the border if that is, in fact, the agenda. We also know that the Obama administration put out a tender for a contract last January for caretakers for an estimated 60,000 people. We know that there have actually been TV commercials running down in Central America saying if you can get to the United States, there will be amnesty. We know that Guatemala and Mexico came into an agreement to make it easier for people from Guatemala to transit Mexico and get to the border. It seems like there's this giant pipeline set up to funnel these people up here. What is the reason for it? Well, there's a couple of possibilities. One is we know that the globalists are trying to form a North American Union to drop the border between the U.S. and Mexico and then eventually do the same thing to Canada to form a single union like the European Union.
You think they're just going to... You're going to say, oh, there's no way we can control the borders anymore. So just throw their hands up and say, we may as well make it all one country.
Yeah, something along that line. And looking at the spectacular success of the European Union, I can understand why people are opposed to that here in the United States of America. There's another possibility in that all of these illegals being brought in and given ID cards and being told they can, but they're instant Democratic voters. And we know that the Democratic Party is looking at serious losses, not only this coming November, but in 2016. But beyond that, it may be that Obama is listening to his ego because his administration really has been a bit of a disaster. Fiscal stimulus didn't work. Obamacare is a complete disaster. Human-caused global warming and the carbon taxes didn't work out. But Obama was always making a big deal about his contribution to the history books was going to be immigration reform. And it may be that he's simply flooding all of these people into the U.S. and mixing them into the general population to force Congress to finally vote through the amnesty that Obama wants. so that Obama can go into the history books with this being his great accomplishment. And it's a very foolish and reckless reason for doing this, because there is a major health crisis in the making here, where they're now having to quarantine entire buildings of these illegals because they're carrying infectious tuberculosis. There have been contagions of infectious tuberculosis out in California at two schools where the illegals have been sent. We know that some of these people coming across the border are carrying HIV, H1N1, certainly a lot of body lice and other issues, and now apparently bubonic plague, which is a big problem in Central America. And my concern here is, we know there's this major Ebola outbreak in Africa, the largest one on record. There have been hints that it's already outside of Africa. There was one story in Italy, one story in Spain that were said came out, we've got Ebola patients. Then they came back and said, no. It was Ebola-like symptoms, but it wasn't Ebola. Trust us. But imagine that somebody from West Africa flew to Brazil for the World Cup, and they bumped into somebody who bumped into somebody who's moving north, who bumps into somebody else who gets on that train coming to the United States of America. There is no cure for Ebola. There is no vaccine. And if that comes across the border, we're looking at legal American citizens being exposed to these serious medical conditions to serve this immigration agenda, and it just doesn't make any sense. If a foreign government sent thousands of people into our country carrying infectious diseases, we would call it an act of biological warfare. So what do we call it when it's the president who seems to be doing this?
Right, but they're all cute children. That's what we're hearing about. We can't deny these cute children.
Well, no, they are. There's gang members coming in. MS-13 is coming in. And, I was looking at Nancy Pelosi. She was down there on the border for a photo op and saying that we should treat these children like they're refugee baby Jesus. And yet she's perfectly okay with Israel bombing the kids in Gaza, who, according to statisticians and geneticists, really are distant blood relations of the historical Jesus.
Right. Hey, we have a caller here who wants to get on the air here. So let's go to the phones. Hello, all caller. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. Michael, you're a fountain of information. I've never heard you before. Today's the first time. I always listen to KKCR. And I went on Coast to Coast with George Norrie's website and see you've been a guest on there in the past. Please get back on there again. This information that you have is wonderful, and so many people listen to it, millions, in fact. So I'd love to hear you on there again. But what you're saying is not only informative, but it's waking people up. And I think a lot of people aren't really too aware about the crisis that we're headed for. Now, what is your thought about people that have money in the bank, even if you have a little bit of gold, if you have the bulk of your savings in an account, if the banks have a crisis and they're shut down, what do you think a person should do as far as keeping their money in the bank? Should they take cash out and have it in a reserve, even though it's going to be devaluated? Or just invest a heck of a lot of it in gold and silver? What's your thought?
Okay, well, first of all, remember what happened in Cyprus. When the banks got into trouble, the Cyprus government changed the law so the banks could help themselves to the savings account. They're talking about doing that in Europe. It's already written into the fiscal plan for Canada for this year, an emergency measure. Apparently, the SEC passed a new regulation earlier this week where they can freeze the money market accounts so that you can't withdraw from them if the banks get into trouble. You need to understand the government is placing the banks at a higher priority than the American people. And especially with this idea where they're talking about bank account holders are no longer customers. They're considered as unsecured investors in the bank and therefore liable for the bank's losses, which is a fancy way of saying when the bank gets into trouble, they're going to help themselves to what is in your savings account, possibly what's in your safety deposit box. Now, obviously, you need to keep enough money in the bank to handle your daily transactions and your obligations, but I don't think it's wise to have a huge amount in that bank. I definitely recommend physical silver and gold, and under your own control, because even the safety deposit boxes aren't safe. It's really a very dangerous situation. You were talking about my being on George Norrie's show. I was also on a TV show this last year called America's Book of Secrets, It's on the H2 History Channel, and I was on five of the episodes. But one of the episodes I did was called The Gold Conspiracy, and it's talking about how the New York Federal Reserve, which is supposed to be this premier bank in the United States, appears to have been taking the gold left there on deposit by foreign governments, primarily Germany, and leasing it out the back door, using it as collateral, just playing games with it to the point where they don't have the gold to give back on demand. And there was a big stink where Germany asked for some of their gold back. The Federal Reserve said no. Germany said, can we at least look at it and count it? Federal Reserve said no. And from political pressure, Germany kind of backed off. But I'm sure Germany is very, very concerned that the gold they have on deposit in the vault at the New York Federal Reserve may not be there any longer.
Yes, I heard of that. And I guess is savings and loan, or not savings and loan, excuse me, credit unions, are they safer than the banks?
I would say smaller neighborhood depositor banks are safe. Credit unions are safe. It's these big national scale banks that have been caught up in a lot of these Wall Street games. They're the ones at risk, but they're all ultimately tangled in with that Federal Reserve system. And when that comes down, they're all pretty much going to come down together. Really, keep as much of your wealth under your own control as you can. Bring it home, some as cash, some as silver and gold. Obviously, don't tell your friends and neighbors that you've done that because you're setting yourself up to be a bit of a target.
Sure.
You know, spread it around the house. Don't have it in one little place where somebody can grab it. Just common sense kind of stuff. Bury it in a mayonnaise jar out by the pineapple plantation. But at this point,
one other question. EMPs, if we have it through a natural a disaster or through a foreign country, what do you think is the possibility of having an EMP strike us?
That's an electromagnetic pulse weapon.
No, I know what it is.
No, I'm telling the listeners, the other listeners.
Oh, okay. Now, here's what's going on with that. There are very few natural events that cause an EMP. Usually you're talking something on the scale of the sun blowing up, in which case the EMP is going to be the least of our worries. An EMP is generated when a nuclear weapon is detonated above the atmosphere, and it creates a pulse in the Earth's magnetic field that can induce huge voltages in very long-running lines, like high-tension lines. Now, here in Hawaii, our high-tension lines don't go that long. Now, we do know there was some EMP damage from an early nuclear test outside the atmosphere, but for small local appliances running on batteries, they're probably going to be immune. And for those of you who have computer equipment, if you've got a surge protector, that's probably going to work. Obviously, if we're in a situation where we're seeing rockets leap up out of the ships here in Pearl Harbor, you might want to pull the breakers or unplug things from the wall, because where the amp actually creates the capability of causing damage is in those long, high-tension wires. They act like a field coil as the magnetic pulse sweeps by, and it can generate a very powerful, high-voltage pulse. But it can't work over a very small distance.
What about automobiles?
It would have to be a really intense amp to damage an automobile. It might damage some of the sensitive electronics like the stereo and the radio, but especially when you consider that cars just sitting on their tires are insulated from the ground, I don't think we're going to see a lot of that.
Now, there was an event, I was just looking at the NASA website the other day. 2 years ago yesterday, there was a coronal mass ejection from the sun. It went out to the Earth's orbit. Fortunately, the Earth wasn't there at the time, but it was strong enough that it would have fried all the electronics, at least on the sun-facing side of the Earth, maybe beyond that.
That's right.
And would have knocked our technology back about 100 years.
That's right.
I mean, would have knocked out all communications, all electrical systems in the entire country.
Well, that is a possibility.
That's a natural event, but, certainly a possibility.
It is a natural event. Well, it has happened before. The New York blackout was started by that. But over the ensuing years, most of the power companies have installed equipment to try and mitigate that kind of damage. The reason it happened before was nobody was expecting it. They didn't even know what caused it when it happened, and it took a while to figure it out. Yes, that kind of an event can cause damage. On the other hand, sometimes these kind of claims are overplayed by scientists who are trying to get funding to study the problem and solve it. And we look at all the brouhaha about human-caused global warming, where, you know, 10 years ago they were saying snow was going to be a thing of the past, and now, of course, we've had several record-setting winters in a row. It looks like we're heading into another one now, and they're scrambling and saying, well, global warming causes snow and ice and so forth. And it's all driven by funding, who's handing out the money. They call it the golden rule of science. Whoever has the gold decides what the science is going to be. Remember killer bees, Y2K. There's a lot of hysteria in some of these warnings because it leads to media attention and funding will follow. So is there a possibility that a significantly large coronal mass ejection could cause damage? Yes. Is it going to be as devastating as they're saying? I'm not sure. I'm ready to buy into that yet.
All right. Well, thank you for your answer. I appreciate it. Aloha.
Okay. In response, okay. In response to the caller's questions about the financial system, where you keep your money, a lot of people feel comfortable that their bank, that their money is in a institution that is insured by the FDIC, you know, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which, you know, covers all deposits over, it was 100,000, went up to 250,000, maybe down to 100,000 again, I don't know. But the FDIC is funded to the tune of about $50 billion, whereas the total deposit bank out there is in the order of $5 trillion. So it's only a small percentage of the overall deposits that are insured, that will be insured, will be covered if some significant financial event does happen.
Yeah, the FDIC is set up to deal with a single bank or a small bank chain going under and going in and cleaning up the mess. But in the event of the entire system coming down, the FDIC doesn't really have the resources to make good on everybody's bank account. And the reality is that if the dollar's value is crashing, it's not going to matter anyway. Diversification really is the key to survival. And I think if you talk to any professional financial planner, which I am not, look at my bank balance and you'll understand you shouldn't be taking economic advice from me anyway. But you want to diversify. You want some in cash, some in gold, some in silver, so that whatever happens to any one of those economic areas, it's going to be less, your other areas are going to be taking care of you.
Okay. Hey, we have another caller. Let's go to the phones. Aloha,
hey there,
caller.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air.
You know, I'd appreciate it if you'd verify some of the information that you're dealing with. You know, at KKCR, we're trying to get some verifiable information that we can repeat. We're trying to be scientific, and when you say that all science is the rule of the gold, you're being a little bit ridiculous there. And
well, not really. I'm a former scientist myself.
I think you ought to verify some of your information. You've been talking for a long time.
Michael, let him
please
talk.
Please don't talk for a couple seconds here. I think you ought to verify some of your information, or at least say if you have any credentials that are legitimate or anything like that. I mean, whether I agree with you or not is not the issue, but you're speaking from some kind of position of authority, and I'm curious who authorized you or who gave you that authority, what gave you that authority. And if you want to discuss that, that'd be great. Otherwise, I just get a gut feeling, you know, that it's not appropriate for you to be taking up so much public airspace with not verifiable information. You know what I mean?
Well,
It has the effect kind of alarming everybody and negating all the positive things that we're all involved with.
And creating
a sense of hopelessness. So we're really not into that, and that's not what KKCR's mission is. Advertisements on your website, if I remember, I looked at it one time, and you got advertisements for profit on your website that, you know, we don't advertise. If you want to be a underwriter, you can underwrite, but you know, it's not appropriate for you to be drawing people to your website as if it's something legitimate and then for you to be selling something on it.
Caller, can I ask you a quick question? What in particular do you question him on?
Well, I'm just in general, you talk.
Okay, but do you have any specific
red flag?
Right, but that's not much to go on.
When you don't qualify yourself and give any verification of anything, that's a red flag.
But you're being very vague here. I'm trying to determine what exactly.
I'm just being general. Right, yeah, but I'm not really interested in debating any of your positions. I'm just talking about your general approach to the situation. You know what
it's
I mean?
It's sort of a non-directional bashing, in other words.
What's that?
It's a non-directional bashing, in other words.
Well, that would be a silly way, an innocent way to look at it. But, you know, a lot of us are involved in productive things we're trying to do to make the world better. And we're not really interested in all this unverifiable opinion about stuff. You know, unless you can verify it by legitimate means, then we're interested in discussing it. But also, we'd like to have other people on the show. If you're going to take an hour of the show, we ought to have somebody on from some other media source to talk about this thing with you to balance out just your approach to talking. You know what I mean? We should have a balance on there and not just allow one person on there for an hour when you're not, you know, acknowledging any of your sources of anything. I mean, that's a little goofy for somebody to be talking so long and not acknowledging any sources. The reason I know that is because KKCR has had an incredible amount of professionals on who are legitimate that always acknowledge their sources. And so when you're not, it's like, you know, you're standing out, you're sticking out like a sore thumb.
Okay, yeah. Michael, do you want to respond to that now?
I want to respond to that. First of all, I always get kind of worried when everybody says, you know, legitimate sources, like they're expecting to divide the world between those who are approved by the establishment versus those who are not.
No. I'm talking about...
Now, wait a minute. I waited for you to talk. I waited for you to talk, and now it's your turn to wait while I respond.
Well, you didn't wait. You interrupted me a few times, so I'll take my credits now, okay? So we're talking about universities that are generally accepted, and not private universities, publicly funded universities, okay? And also, Rick, and also peer-reviewed. Peer-reviewed scientific information that can be verified and repeated. Okay,
are you done? Can I talk?
Yep, go.
Okay, all right. Going on back to the human-caused global warming hysteria, look at how many universities and government agencies like NASA and NOAA were in on this idea to convince human beings that the world was getting warmer and that we were to blame.
It's not in on it. See, that's what I'm saying. You've got this conspiracy thing driving you.
Okay, you know, if you'd actually read my website, if you'd actually read the ClimateGate page that I wrote, the sites and sources are in there. Frankly, it sounds to me like you just want to come in here and voice your opinion that you don't like what I'm saying.
No, that's
you don't
not
have
true.
Any,
you that's
don't
not
have any
true
specific.
At all. We had a problem with you on Vandeveer show. We used to come on and monopolize a lot of time, you know, and that's what we're trying to get some kind of verification of information. You know,
go to my website.
It's irrelevant
all
whether
there.
I like
it's
it or not.
It's all there. You're just you don't
but
want
you're
to
not
do
giving
it.
Any
you
on
to,
the
you don't
air.
Like what I'm saying.
But you're not
you
giving
don't...
any on the air now though. That's what I'm saying. You haven't given any. I've been listening for a little while and you haven't given
the
any.
Reason I run this website, the reason I've run the website for the last 20 years is to make this information available to people. And a lot of it goes back to the source documents, and we pull out the source information and say, see, this is what they're saying then. This is what they're saying now. They don't line up. Obviously, somebody is...
It's not just the source documents. It's legitimate peer-reviewed source documents.
Well, the peer-review process itself has come into serious concern because that also has been hijacked by a lot of the politicians behind this global warming, where they claim
to
have
peer... Yeah, but we still have the remnants of it, and we still make some progress with peer review.
Well, what I recommend to my listeners...
That's what I'm saying. See, that's what I'm trying to say. By you saying that something is totally hijacked, that's a little bit ridiculous.
Okay, caller. Caller.
People scatter all over.
Yeah, I've got 5 minutes left.
Sorry, caller. I'm gonna cut you off because you've made your point, and now we want to give Michael a chance to respond. Without interruption, and we only have a couple minutes left in the show. So, Michael.
I remember when this guy used to call in when I was doing the show with Mike Vandeveer. Okay, basically what we tell our listeners and our readers is that scientific method is a very powerful tool for determining what the truth is. And we always encourage everybody to go on out and find your own sources, find out the facts and decide for yourself. In fact, Thomas Jefferson said the highest duty of any citizen is to be fully informed so you can make good choices. Unfortunately, the reason there is a scientific method is the recognition that individual scientists are just as easy to corrupt as individual politicians or individual clergy or individual media people. And that's what scientific method is really all about. But we have seen science hijacked, sensationalized, in order to generate a profit, whether it's Y2K or killer bees, human-caused global warming. And in our page on ClimateGate, we do have documentation. We have a photograph of an official NOAA temperature monitoring station sited right next to a trash incinerator to illustrate how they were trying to artificially inflate temperature numbers to support this agenda for carbon taxes and carbon credit. And again, for people certainly in the northern latitudes looking out their window these last few winters, it's very obvious the world isn't getting any warmer. The sun is supposed to be at its maximum. It's got zero sunspots right now, and it looks like we're going into a Newmonder minimum. Now, I've been running my website for about, and over those 20 years, I've developed a good reputation for people being able to come in, read the articles, follow the links to the original sources, and I get very concerned when somebody says legitimate sources, because what that tells me right there and then is they're setting up an argument to say these people are legitimate because they work for this organization or they've got these awards on the wall, and anybody who doesn't agree with them is illegitimate and shouldn't be listened to. And that is the first warning sign that somebody is trying to steer public opinion rather than letting the public go on out and figure it out for themselves, which I have every confidence everybody listening to this show is going to be smart enough to go out, find the facts in this age of the Internet, and figure out, yeah, we got lied to. We got lied to about Saddam's nuclear weapons. We got lied to about human-caused global warming. And once you realize that you're surrounded by government and corporate media that is lying to you, you take it upon yourself to find out what the truth is going to be and find out where you're going to get the most accurate information.
Okay, Michael, I just have a couple minutes left. We've got another caller who's been waiting patiently, and hopefully we can be very quick, get a quick response, and then the show will be over then. So we're going to go to the phones here. Okay, caller, you're on the air. If you could be really brief with your question, please.
Okay, I have a question. I just wanted to say thank you for the show, and thank you, Michael. I think you really do a wonderful job telling people what's going on in the world. And, yeah, of course, we can research it ourselves. There's so much crazy stuff. I was just saying to my friend yesterday, gosh, it feels like our system, the U.S. system, and all this modern money system thing is like an elephant jumping off a cliff, and it's about to hit the ground. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, this is looking great. This system's working great. And it's, like, just about to hit the ground, right? So thank you so much for explaining it, and have a great day.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the kind words.
Okay, Michael. Well, thank you very much for coming on to the show here. For all the listeners, you know, KKCR does not support his website. We only brought him on to give his perspective on these issues so that we have more information to make our own decisions. But very good talking to you. I know you were a regular back in the day, and hopefully we can have you back on again one day.
I look forward to it.
Okay. That's all the time we have in the show. We're going to go out a little Bob Dylan. I'll be back in 2 weeks. And next week, Jimmy Trujillo will be on Out of the Box. So, aloha. Thanks for all the great calls. See you in 2 weeks.